Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center, reading the New York Times for Thursday, February 19, 2026. As Trump obliterates climate efforts, states try to fill the gap. By Maxine Josselow. In Colorado, historically a hub of coal mining, legislators are planning to give drivers a $2,000 discount on new electric vehicles, more than double the current amount offered by the state. In Virginia, where data centers are driving a record surge in electricity demand, lawmakers want to make it easier for counties to approve sprawling solar farms. And in California, a longtime leader in environmental policy, legislators want fossil fuel companies to help cover soaring home insurance costs caused by wildfires and other climate disasters. Across the country, Democratic-led states are accelerating their efforts to address climate change as action stalls at the federal level. Their initiatives took on newfound urgency last week when the Trump administration moved to stop regulating greenhouse gases from the burning of fossil fuels, the main driver of Earth's dangerous warming. Experts said a patchwork of state climate policies was no substitute for federal leadership. But they added that state action would be crucial for the United States, historically the largest emitter of greenhouse gases, to continue shifting away from fossil fuels and toward cleaner energy while President Trump remains in office. The transition to cleaner, non-fossilized fuel is happening very rapidly, even though Donald Trump is trying to slow down this progress, said Jay Inslee, a Democrat and the former governor of Washington State. The states are tremendous powers in this clean energy transition we're going through. The Environmental Protection Agency on Thursday overturned the scientific determination that carbon dioxide, methane, and four other greenhouse gases were a threat to public health and welfare. Known as the endangerment finding, the ruling had required the government to limit these gases from passenger cars and trucks, oil and gas wells, power plants, and other industrial facilities. The end of federal greenhouse gas limits is an obstacle, but not a death knell, in the fight against climate change on the state level, experts said. Colorado helps explain why. In 2019, Governor Jared Polis, a Democrat, set an ambitious goal of reducing the state's greenhouse gas emissions 50% by 2030 from 2005 levels. Colorado is now on track to meet this goal by 2032, a two-year delay for which local leaders have largely blamed the Trump administration's environmental rollbacks. Will Tuer, the executive director of the Colorado Energy Office, said the erasure of greenhouse gas limits on cars was an especially big blow. Transportation is the largest single source of greenhouse gases in Colorado and in the United States. To get more drivers into electric vehicles, Colorado legislators are trying carrots rather than sticks. In the coming weeks, they plan to introduce a bill that would provide a $2,000 tax credit toward new electric vehicle purchases starting in 2027, up from the current amount of $750. Colorado already expanded an additional rebate of up to $9,000 for low and moderate income households to buy new EVs after the Republican-controlled Congress repealed a federal incentive of up to $7,500 last summer. Trump is slowing down the transition, but the overall trajectory in Colorado will still be toward a pretty rapid reduction in greenhouse gas pollution and rapid adoption of electric vehicles, Mr. Tuer said. Across the country in Virginia, lawmakers are eager to expand solar energy. The Virginia House and Senate recently passed a bill that would prohibit local governments from banning large solar projects. The legislation would also provide guidance for localities by recommending that solar projects be built at least 150 feet away from homes and at least 50 feet from roadways. Opposition to solar projects as well as wind farms has grown across the country in recent years. Some critics of solar facilities have falsely claimed that they are expensive and inefficient, while others have raised concerns about the loss of prime farmland to development. Nearly two-thirds of Virginia's counties have passed ordinances that effectively prohibit large solar facilities, either through outright bans or unworkable restrictions. For instance, Flavanna County requires solar farms to be built at least 375 feet from property lines and 500 feet from homes, which is difficult in parts of the region between Charlottesville and Richmond. The trend could prevent Virginia from meeting its aggressive target of running on 100% renewable electricity by 2050. Power demand is also soaring statewide, in large part because of a boom in artificial intelligence data centers, which can use as much electricity as a small city. We need to do everything we can to get more cheap energy online, and that means a lot more solar, said State Senator Schuyler Van Valkenburg, a Democrat who sponsored the bill, which is expected to reach the desk of Governor Abigail Spanberger in the coming weeks. Representatives for Ms. Spanberger, a moderate Democrat who took office in January, did not respond to questions about whether she would sign the measure. Besides large solar farms, momentum is also building for small solar energy systems that can fit on balconies and in backyards. Lawmakers in 24 states have introduced bills that would allow homeowners and renters to install these systems, which produce enough electricity to power a laptop or small refrigerator. Is it a silver bullet? No, Liz Krueger, a Democratic state senator in New York, said of the measures. But is it an opportunity for a huge new set of solar systems at a cost of $300 per unit? Hello, yes. The buzz behind so-called balcony solar units is bipartisan. In Utah, which last year became the first state to allow these systems, State Representative Raymond P. Ward, a Republican who sponsored the bill, said the concept had broad appeal. People are like, oh, I can just buy that and plug it in, Mr. Ward previously told the New York Times. Oh, yes, I want one of those. When it comes to climate measures among the states, many are looking toward California, which has been a national leader since the 1950s, when severe smog in Los Angeles helped galvanize the modern environmental movement. Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, announced one of the nation's most aggressive climate goals in 2020, banning the sale of new gasoline-powered vehicles by 2035. But last year, Mr. Trump blocked California from enforcing the ban, which 11 other states had intended to follow. At the same time, Mr. Newsom and Democratic lawmakers backtracked on other green initiatives in an effort to address the high cost of living in the state. For instance, they backed legislation that would keep oil refineries open and make it easier to drill for oil in California. But some of the biggest climate hawks in the California State Assembly are now promoting a measure that would require oil and gas companies to help pay for home insurance coverage. The cost of this coverage has skyrocketed in recent years because of wildfires, including the devastating blazes that tore through the Los Angeles area last year. If your house is burning down and your insurance costs are quadrupling, or you no longer have insurance, your life is now more expensive and worse because of climate change, said State Senator Scott Wiener, a Democrat who introduced the legislation. Beyond the insurance bill, Mr. Wiener added, California needs to triple down on our state-level climate policies now that Trump has just eliminated all of the federal rules. It is unclear what tripling down might look like. Lauren Sanchez, the chair of the California Air Resources Board, the state's powerful air and climate regulator, said in an email, "We will continue to stand up for the right to breathe clean air and keep driving forward in every way possible." She did not comment on whether or how the board would continue to reduce greenhouse gases from automobiles. The state is suing the federal government to maintain its own strict clean car rules. Casey Kadams, the executive director of the U.S. Climate Alliance, a bipartisan coalition of governors working on climate policy, said that from 2005 to 2023, states and territories reduced their net greenhouse gas emissions by 24%. If they continue that trend, Mr. Kadem said, states can make up for the loss of the federal government's support in driving down climate pollution, at least for the next 3 years. But we have our work cut out for us, he added. After avalanche warnings, a Sierra Nevada tragedy, by Thomas Fuller and Jill Cowan. It was announced as the first big blizzard of the year in California, and the warnings were stark. The National Weather Service posted on Sunday that avalanche danger was high. It rated the danger 4 out of 5 and said travel to avalanche-prone areas was not recommended. As many families cut short their President's Day weekends and rushed home to beat the storm, 15 intrepid skiers, including 4 professional guides, ventured out on Sunday for a 3-day trek into a remote part of the Sierra Nevada, where just a few weeks earlier a man had been buried in an avalanche. Another one struck at 11:30 a.m. on Tuesday, as the group was finishing up its trip in the middle of the blizzard. Avalanche, someone yelled, just before the group was buried, according to survivors' accounts relayed to Captain Rusty Green of the Nevada County Sheriff's Department. It overtook them rather quickly, Captain Green said. On Wednesday, officials announced that 8 of the skiers had been found dead after being overcome by the avalanche, which was the size of a football field. Another skier was missing and presumed killed. It was the worst snow disaster in modern California history. 6 members of the group, 1 man and 5 women, were rescued after they contacted the authorities on Tuesday afternoon by using avalanche beacons and their iPhone's SOS satellite functions. They sheltered under a tarp until rescuers reached them. Rescue teams used a snowcat, a vehicle with tank-like treads, and traveled hours over rugged terrain before making contact with the 6 survivors at 5:30 p.m. on Tuesday, said Sheriff Shannon Moon of Nevada County. The survivors led them to 3 people they had found who were all dead, she said. The rescue team then located 5 other people who had also been killed. It took several hours for the rescuers and survivors to leave the mountain in the dark. 2 of the 6 survivors were taken to a hospital for treatment. The power of Tuesday's avalanche was rated 2.5 out of 5.0 on the destructive force scale by the Sierra Avalanche Center, a nonprofit organization that works with the U.S. Forest Service. A 2.0 avalanche on the scale displaces enough snow to bury a person, while a 3.0 is large enough to bury a car. The authorities did not immediately identify the dead, but the Placer County Sheriff, Wayne Wu, said that one of the people who had died was the spouse of a member of the rescue team that rushed to find survivors. In a separate statement, Sugar Bowl Academy, a ski-focused school near the avalanche site, said that multiple victims had ties to its community. Because of the hazardous conditions, the 8 bodies had not been brought down as of Wednesday evening. Of the 9 dead or presumed dead, 7 were women and 2 men. The avalanche struck on Tuesday morning near Castle Peak, a backwoods area near Truckee, California, that is cherished for its beauty. It was not far from the site of one of California's most notorious disasters, the decimation of the Donner Party in the winter of 1847, when 3 dozen settlers died of starvation and exposure during a fierce winter, and some survivors resorted to cannibalism. The area has now become a major ski destination for the San Francisco Bay Area and the Sacramento region. Mountain guides and backcountry skiers said Wednesday that they were struggling to understand why the 15 skiers had gone out in such treacherous conditions. But they empathized. The thrill of backcountry skiing, the joys of slicing through powder away from groomed ski resort slopes, also makes it inherently dangerous. The 15 skiers caught in Tuesday's avalanche had been staying at the Frog Lake Backcountry Huts, according to a statement from Blackbird Mountain Guides, the company responsible for the tour group. The huts are in a remote valley connected to the outside world only by a dirt trail. But they are less than 2 miles as the crow flies from Interstate 80, the highway that bisects the Sierra. The highway was closed during the height of the storm, deemed too dangerous to use by the authorities. One person who had signed up for the ski tour decided not to go at the last minute, according to Sheriff Moon, who did not elaborate on why the person had backed out. In an email, Blackbird staff members referred all questions about the avalanche to the Nevada County Sheriff's Office. As the storm approached the area, experts saw a specific danger inherent in the pattern of this year's snowfall, one that Blackbird staff members appeared to be aware of. In a video posted by the company on Sunday, a staff member pointed out that fresh snow on top of a weak layer from the preceding months could lead to unpredictable avalanches. The video was filmed on Mount Rose, about an hour drive from Castle Peak, where the avalanche struck. On Sunday, when the group set off, the Reno, Nevada office of the National Weather Service posted on social media that avalanche danger was high for Sunday through Thursday, rating it as 4 out of 5 in danger. The post said travel into avalanche terrain was not recommended. Warnings of avalanche danger in the backcountry of the Tahoe Basin are not uncommon and happen several times a year during big storms. The Sierra Avalanche Center had most recently issued a high danger warning on Christmas Day in 2025. It was one of 10 days with such a warning last year. On Tuesday morning, the National Weather Service issued avalanche warnings across the region, including the Greater Lake Tahoe area, through at least early Wednesday. Large avalanches are expected across backcountry terrain, the warning said. The warning, which echoed what the Blackbird staff member had posted in his Sunday video, explained that rapidly accumulating snowfall was piling on top of weak layers in the existing snowpack. The danger was compounded by gale-force winds causing snow to blow and drift. Natural avalanches are likely, and human-triggered avalanches large enough to bury or injure people are very likely, the Weather Service said. Ryan Ochoa, a spokesman for the Truckee Fire Protection District, said on Tuesday that rescuers from the department had tried to make it to the skiers soon after the initial call for help late Tuesday morning, but could not reach their remote area. The storm had also ruled out efforts to use a helicopter to rescue the stranded skiers, Mr. Ochoa said. Heinz Muller, a mountain guide in the village of Andermatt, Switzerland, said that few people who are buried in avalanches survive longer than half an hour. Mr. Muller, who was rescued from an avalanche in the Alps in 1993 after being buried for 2.5 hours, said the two main dangers are suffocation and the possibility that the body's temperature will fall too low for too long. If you are buried in an avalanche and you are still breathing, the hole you are breathing in starts to form ice, and then it's the same like you are breathing in a plastic bag, he said. He said when he was trapped, he had managed to make a larger breathing hole, but that by the time he was rescued, he had been close to death, as his body temperature had fallen precipitously. The avalanche was the deadliest in the United States, since one in 1981 on Mount Rainier in Washington State killed 11 people, according to data compiled by the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. A 1982 avalanche in Alpine Meadows, a Sierra ski resort, killed 7 people and was considered the deadliest in modern California history until Tuesday's disaster. Across the United States, an average of 27 people have died in avalanches annually over the last 10 winters, according to the Colorado Avalanche Information Center. So far this season, there have been 6 reported deaths. Blackbird Mountain Guides specializes in backcountry ski trips in remote areas beyond the groomed slopes of resorts. The company also runs courses to help skiers identify avalanche risks and perform rescues. The area around the Frog Lake huts is familiar terrain for the company, which runs regular tours there. Dave Pallavi, a member of the town council in Truckee and owner of a specialty outdoor store, has stayed numerous times in the huts, which are modern enclosed living quarters offering heat, hot water, and electricity. He described the area as really spectacular scenery, a lake surrounded by evergreens with a backdrop of rocky cliffs. Mr. Pallavi said the dangers of an avalanche always lurked in the steep terrain. I think always in the back of our heads, we always knew there could be this kind of tragedy, he said. Jackson's death arrives at a crucial moment for black political power. By Reed J. Epstein and Nick Corasaniti. The Reverend Jesse Jackson's death comes at a moment when black voters are hugely influential within the Democratic Party, and there are more black senators than ever before, yet the future of black representation in the House of Representatives is uncertain. The Supreme Court is set to rule in the coming months on a case that will determine the fate of a key provision in the Voting Rights Act of 1965, the federal law that undergirds Southern black representation in the House. In arguments last fall, the conservative-leaning court seemed skeptical of a key provision of the law, a signature achievement of the civil rights era. Black voters overwhelmingly support the Democratic Party, despite President Trump's notable gains with them in 2024, and some Democrats and black faith leaders argue that the country is going backward on civil rights. We are witnessing right now, in real time, the kind of attack on voting rights that really does harken back to the darkest days of the civil rights struggle, Senator Raphael Warnock, a Georgia Democrat and the pastor of the historic Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta, said on Tuesday, I owe it to Reverend Jackson, and we owe it to the next generation, to pass voting rights and ensure that we level the playing field so that every voice can be heard in our democracy. Some conservatives say that decades of rising political power for black Americans mean that old legal and policy interventions like the Voting Rights Act are no longer necessary. During oral arguments in the case in October, Justice Brett M. Kavanaugh said, This court's cases, in a variety of contexts, have said that race-based remedies are permissible for a period of time, sometimes for a long period of time, decades in some cases, but that they should not be indefinite and should have an end point. Some black Republicans, however, have voiced support for the civil rights legislation. I think the Voting Rights Act is very important. It's an important part of our history. Ben Carson, a housing secretary in the first Trump administration, said in an interview, We should unite around that fact and not let ourselves be divided. Mr. Carson, who said that he had met Mr. Jackson while still a surgeon and that the civil rights leader had been an early supporter of his books, added, What's necessary is that Americans have their voting rights protected, all Americans. For Democrats, defending the voting rights of black Americans is also about politics. The influence of black voters in Democratic presidential primary contests is undeniable. In 2008, 2016, and 2020, southern states where the primary electorates are dominated by black voters swung heavily towards the party's eventual nominees. In those primary races, black voters in South Carolina and then across the South helped lift Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, and Joseph R. Biden Jr. to victory, thwarting Mrs. Clinton in her first run, Bernie Sanders, and then Mr. Sanders again. In each case, black voters were pragmatic, said Jamie Harrison, a former chairman of both the Democratic National Committee and the South Carolina Democratic Party, choosing a candidate they believed had the best chance of winning the general election. And now, before the order of states has been set for the 2028 primary contest, a parade of would-be White House hopefuls have made their way to South Carolina. Governors Gavin Newsom of California and Andy Beshear of Kentucky, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, Representative Ro Khanna of California, and others have visited the state in recent months with an apparent eye on ingratiating themselves with its largely black primary electorate. You've seen it election cycle after election cycle, Mr. Harrison said, The black vote has been determinative in the presidential primary. As the first domino falls in South Carolina, it falls the same way across the rest of the South. Of the 11 black people ever elected to the Senate, 5 are serving now. Mr. Booker, Mr. Warnock, and Senators Angela Alsobrooks of Maryland and Lisa Blunt Rochester of Delaware, both Democrats. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina is the lone black Republican senator. Ms. Alsobrooks said in an interview on Tuesday that there was responsibility and pride in knowing that she is part of the largest group of black senators to ever serve together. She said the impact went beyond policies debated on the Senate floor. She recalled a day last summer when she arrived after having had her hair braided. "I went to walk onto the Senate floor when one of the U.S. Capitol police officers stopped me, and he was thrilled," she said. "He said, 'Can I please take a photo with you?'" She added, "He had been in that building for many years and said, 'Do you know you're the first person to have ever stepped on the floor of the United States Senate with your hair in braids?'" The provision before the Supreme Court, Section 2, prohibits election or voting practices that discriminate on the basis of race. That guidance has led to the creation of majority-minority districts that are meant to help voters of color elect candidates of their choice. If the court fully struck down the provision, Democrats could lose about a dozen majority-minority districts across the South, according to an analysis by the New York Times. Many of those seats are currently held by black lawmakers. Even before the Supreme Court ruling arrives, several Republican-led states have already eliminated districts with black House representatives during the nation's current gerrymandering battle. In Texas, Representative Mark Vesey, a Democrat, announced he would not run for re-election after he was drawn out of his seat. Representative Al Green, another Democrat, was drawn out of his longtime district and will now run for a different seat in a March primary race. In North Carolina, Representative Don Davis will have a much more difficult re-election fight after the state redrew its maps in October. And in Missouri, a new map threatens the re-election chances of Representative Emanuel Cleaver, a Democrat who has spent 20 years in Congress and was the first black mayor of Kansas City. This century, the Supreme Court has chipped away at the Voting Rights Act. In 2013, the court struck down another key provision, Section 5, which required states with a history of racial discrimination at the polls to obtain federal approval before changing voting laws. Chief Justice John G. Roberts, Jr. wrote in that opinion that things have changed dramatically since the law's adoption decades previously. During oral arguments on the current Voting Rights Act case, Hashim M. Mupan, a principal deputy solicitor general in the Trump administration, said that many black members of Congress now hailed from districts that were not majority-minority. "None of these positions is going to lead to there being no black representation in Congress or anything remotely approaching that," he said. But civil rights leaders contend that the legal erosion of the Voting Rights Act will hurt black Americans' political power. So here we are, Jesse Jackson dies today, and we have less voting rights protection under the Voting Rights Act than we had on August 6, 1965, said Bishop William Barber II, a civil rights leader. Eric H. Holder, Jr., an attorney general in the Obama administration, said that Mr. Jackson's legacy was under attack at the Supreme Court. Leaders like Reverend Jackson were clear-eyed about the fact that without legal protections, we would never have been able to move past the discriminatory voting practices that were perpetrated with impunity and without legal recourse, Mr. Holder said in a statement. He added, "Reverend Jackson's life and legacy are a reminder that hard-fought victories must be protected and that each generation has a role to play in fighting for equality and justice." At these Gaza schools, peace building is part of the curriculum. By David M. Halbfinger and Bilal Shaber. In the midst of a crowded camp for displaced Palestinians in southern Gaza, a gate with a jarringly upbeat poster of a bright red cartoon racing car sticks out. Inside, a passageway to a compound of tent classrooms is adorned with children's drawings more reflective of real life. One shows an orange and yellow home, green grass and olive trees over the handwritten words, "I had a house, but today I have nothing." Rasil Al-Shayer, 12, pauses to tell a visitor how good it feels to be learning alongside other children again in Almawasi. "Here it is safe," she says, "no drones or bombs. The best thing is sitting at a desk and seeing the teacher and the board and holding a pencil again." Quietly, and despite considerable risk, a network of free private schools for war orphans and other children has sprouted in the Gaza Strip. The schools, called Academies of Hope, are the brainchild of a Palestinian-American neurosurgeon, Dr. David Hassan, who first visited Gaza on medical relief missions soon after Israel invaded Gaza in the wake of the Hamas-led attack on October 7, 2023. Though he hasn't been back to Gaza since early 2024, he has built the institutions by forging partnerships with humanitarian groups on the ground, hiring Palestinian staff over WhatsApp, and raising money, largely from Jewish donors, in the United States and Israel. Some 9,000 pupils in grades 1 through 9 are attending classes in 5 campuses in southern Gaza. They cycle through the schools in 3-hour shifts and receive hot meals and medical and psychological care. Operating schools in any war zone is hard enough, and schools across the enclave are struggling to rebuild. But Dr. Hassan has compounded his challenges. He revamped a much-criticized national curriculum and worked to keep Hamas from endangering his schools. He also verifies that none of his staff have ties to militant groups, a charge Israel has leveled against the United Nations Agency caring for Palestinians in Gaza and some international aid groups. The schools teach a modified version of the Palestinian Authority's curriculum, which is taught in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and Gaza, but without any lessons demonizing Jews or glorifying perpetrators of violence against Israel. Dr. Hassan said the curriculum changes were made without the authority's permission, prompting threats of reprisal from its education ministry. A ministry spokesman did not respond to repeated messages seeking comment. Israel, the United States, and the European Union have long complained that the authority's textbooks inculcate hatred and anti-Semitism. The authority says that its schools appropriately teach Palestinian nationalism, history, and culture. Before and after excerpts from the curriculum illustrate the changes. A math problem comparing the number of martyrs killed in the first and second intifadas has been replaced with one involving attendance at a West Bank soccer match. A reading comprehension selection praising Dalal Mughrabi, a woman who led a 1978 massacre that killed 38 Israelis, 13 of them children, has been replaced with one about Hind al-Husseini, a pioneering Palestinian educator. And in an Islamic studies class, a reading about an attempt by Jews to kill the Prophet Muhammad has been replaced with one about the Prophet's expressions of respect for Jews. Dr. Hassan's team also added new weekly lessons on peace building that teach ideals like tolerance and respect for differences, the golden rule, and conflict resolution. In a video recorded by a school employee during one lesson recently, a boy draws pictures of the Palestinian and Israeli flags side by side. "I wish there will be no more wars so that we can live," he says. Dr. Hassan acknowledged that his peace-building curriculum was politically fraught, and that some of his teachers were fearful of blowback from Hamas as it reestablishes its control over much of Gaza. Some faculty members have quit or been fired over such concerns, he said. He said he was even exploring installing cameras in classrooms to ensure that the curriculum changes are upheld. On social media, some Gazans have asked whether Dr. Hassan's agenda is overly aligned with Israel's. Others, embittered by Hamas, have retorted that it's better to teach tolerance than to teach children to sacrifice themselves. Discomfort with the subject was clear in interviews with faculty members, most of whom had not been hired from other schools. They were either teaching for the first time or were retired principals. They emphasized that they were using the standard Palestinian curriculum, though when pressed, acknowledged some deletions. Ala Saba, 35, who was guiding a class through the basic components of a cell, said he wasn't teaching only science. "We teach respect, tolerance, and accepting others," he said. "We teach them how to rise again like a phoenix and how to come back to life from under the rubble. We teach them to love people and to socialize." When the first school opened last July, Dr. Hassan said he gave the Israeli military the school's coordinates, hoping to protect it. In August, the staff received a warning of an Israeli attack and evacuated. An airstrike soon after hit militants next door. The school suffered little damage, but soon found a new site, Dr. Hassan said. That first school had space for 200 students, he said. On the first day, 500 showed up. Some hadn't had food for days, he said. The kids were so excited. For the first time, they were thriving, he added, and they didn't want to go home. We had to kick them out in the evening. Last summer, as malnutrition was taking hold under an Israeli blockade, Dr. Hassan said he bought tons of flour on the black market for people living in Deir al-Bala. Having earned the gratitude of local elders, he said, he persuaded them to give him space for a school. Since then, he said, leaders of big families in Gaza have helped him obtain space for more schools. "The way we did it is by gaining trust," he said. "One way is by ensuring those families, as well as the Israelis and his donors, that his staff has no ties to militant groups." Dr. Hassan said that every employee had been cleared with the Israeli authorities and checked against a U.S. government sanctions list. He also makes clear that his donors include Israelis. "I told the elders, I work with the Israelis," he said. They said, "As long as they don't want to brainwash our kids, we're fine." A researcher and professor at Duke University's medical school, Dr. Hassan, 53, had no background in humanitarian aid before the 2023 attack, nor was he particularly connected to Palestinian life. Born in Kuwait to Palestinians from the West Bank, he left the Middle East at 18 to attend college in Texas. At 19, he dropped his given name, Ahmad, and called himself David. He said he felt stirred to action by the war. In December 2023, he was in Gaza on a medical mission, performing 20 operations in 10 days, often without anesthetics or antiseptics. He recorded video of maggots crawling out of unhealed wounds. Every patient he operated on, he said, eventually died of infection. He returned the next April with more medical supplies and had better results. But he couldn't get over the number of children being orphaned. Like a 10-year-old girl whom he watched quickly take charge of her younger siblings after their parents had been killed. "The kids, they're the victims of this war," Dr. Hassan said from his home in Durham, North Carolina. "They had no decision in it." He said he had not returned to Gaza since April 2024 because he had aroused suspicion. When he wasn't operating, he said, he was poking into hospital storerooms and asking questions, trying to learn if Israeli hostages might be on the premises. He fled, he said, when he was alerted that armed militants were looking for him. He has also persuaded Jose Andres, the celebrity chef behind World Central Kitchen, to provide meals for the students, along with desks, benches, and bookshelves. Mr. Andres said he has also donated $500,000 to Dr. Hassan's project and plans to give another $500,000. "Sometimes big problems can have very simple solutions that can be solved by somebody with endless energy and not taking no for an answer," he said in an interview. "It's okay to dream big because Gaza requires people like David dreaming big." Dr. Hassan's sixth school, is set to open east of the southern city of Han Yunis, with space for 10,000 children, some college classes, and even a tiny zoo. And he wants to keep opening schools, with a goal to serve as many as 250,000 youngsters by the end of the year. For Shireen Mohammed, 34, the schools have been a godsend to her children. "This is the best thing that has ever happened to us," she said. "Before this place, we were afraid to let our children go anywhere. Now it is safe and productive for them, emotionally, socially, and educationally." Outside the classrooms in Al-Mawasi, Aisha Abu Marzouk, 9, who was displaced from Rafah, said she hoped her new school could add a playground, but she had no complaints. "I don't want to leave this place," she said. "My first day here was the best start to life again." Mamdani to Reinstitute Homeless Encampment Sweeps, by Emma Goldberg and Jeffrey C. Mays. Mayor Zoran Mamdani said on Wednesday that New York City would soon restart sweeping homeless encampments, ending a pause that he instituted on the fifth day of his tenure after expressing skepticism about the approach. The move comes as the mayor's handling of homelessness has come under scrutiny during a recent cold snap in New York City that led to at least 20 deaths, and concerns that the number of encampments has grown since Mr. Mamdani took office. The administration has said it does not believe that any of the deceased were living in encampments. Mr. Mamdani said that he was changing aspects of how the city conducted the sweeps after concluding that the policy under his predecessor, Eric Adams, had put homeless New Yorkers in danger and was ineffective at convincing them to move into shelters. The mayor said that the police department would no longer lead such interagency efforts. Instead, the encampment sweeps would be led by the Department of Homeless Services. He contended that homeless service workers would do far better in trying to convince homeless New Yorkers to leave the streets and seek shelter or services. After posting a notice that an encampment will be cleared, the Department of Homeless Services will send outreach workers to the site daily for a week, with the goal of moving people into shelters and longer-term housing. The mayor's budget plan added funds to hire nearly 60 additional outreach workers. Unlike in the past administration, much of the interaction with homeless New Yorkers was defined by the first day when you provide a notice and the seventh day when you initiate a sweep, Mr. Mamdani said of the encampments. "In our administration, every single day of that time period will be characterized by outreach, outreach from homeless services workers to homeless New Yorkers. If people are still in an encampment after 7 days of outreach visits, the city plans to again offer them shelter and other services and notify them that the site is being dismantled." The mayor's reversal prompted a wave of criticism from social service groups, homelessness advocacy organizations, and people living in encampments, but was also met by praise from some who saw the deaths from the cold as a call for bolder action to help those living on the streets. Addressing the encampments can be an important step toward providing permanent housing and services to people who chronically are on the street, said Elizabeth Glazer, the founder of Vital City, an urban policy think tank. The mayor paused the encampment sweeps on January 5 to reevaluate the way the city conducted site inspections and the removal of the homeless people living there, but has now finished its reassessment of the process. Before taking office, Mr. Mamdani was a staunch critic of dismantling homeless encampments. "If you are not connecting homeless New Yorkers to the housing that they so desperately need, then you cannot deem anything you're doing to be a success," he said. Such comments represented a departure from Mr. Adams, who was more heavy-handed in his approach to moving people off the streets. "It's inhumane to walk by someone that clearly can't take care of their basic needs," Mr. Adams said in November 2023. By reinstituting the encampment sweeps, which was first reported by the New York Post, Mr. Mamdani left himself open to criticism from social service groups that worked with the city's homeless population as well as homeless advocacy groups. The Legal Aid Society and the Coalition for the Homeless released a joint statement that said that Mr. Mamdani's pledge to discontinue homeless sweeps is another broken promise. Joshua Goldfein, a staff attorney at Legal Aid, said that the city's desire to have social service workers, rather than police officers, make the on-the-ground decisions during sweeps was an improvement from the Adams administration's approach, but one that seemed inconsistent with Mr. Mamdani's earlier criticism of the sweeps. Mr. Goldfein also criticized city officials for not being more forthright about their plans, noting that they had yet to issue a revised written policy on the sweeps. What we're seeing right now is a retreat from campaign promises and a lack of meaningful communication, he said. Gail Brewer, a councilwoman who represents the Upper West Side of Manhattan, said she had been dealing with three homeless encampments in her district, two of which were removed late last year under the Adams administration, only to return a few days later. Ms. Brewer said city officials had remained in contact with her about the encampments and that she was willing to give their approach a chance. People are complaining that Mamdani is going back on his word, Ms. Brewer said, but I think they are putting a lot of effort into finding alternatives. Shortly after Mr. Mamdani's announcement, standing inside a homeless encampment on 18th Street and 6th Avenue in Manhattan, LaRon Murray gestured at his belongings, jackets, tools, and gloves he had collected from dumpsters, and described how painful it had been in the past when city officials told him to move. Mr. Murray said he had grown comfortable in the encampment and that the thought of sleeping indoors made him anxious. "They look right in your face and throw your stuff in the trash," said Mr. Murray, 50, who has felt a sense of relief in recent weeks, hearing that the city had paused encampment sweeps. Mr. Murray also noted, though, that sleeping in the cold had been hard on his body, especially one particular night during the recent freeze. "I thought I was going to die," he said. Christine C. Quinn, president and chief executive of WIN, a nonprofit that runs shelters and supportive housing, said she was disappointed that Mr. Mamdani's administration now appeared to be backtracking on two important policies that directly affected homeless New Yorkers, citing the administration's decision not to expand a program that provides rental assistance to keep people in their homes. She said the city seemed to be rushing to respond to the deaths during the cold snap and suggested that a better approach would be to create an entirely new sweep policy. David Giffen, executive director of the Coalition for the Homeless, said he had hoped that it was a sign of things to come when the Mamdani administration began opening more single-occupancy rooms with a low barrier to entry during the recent cold snap. The focus, he said, should be on providing access to the type of housing that homeless individuals are seeking. "Unless you're actually offering people what it is they want and need, it's not going to do anything other than make it harder for people to survive day to day," Mr. Giffen said. The Mamdani administration's approach came under attack last week at a city council hearing, where members pressed the administration on its work during the recent cold weather emergency. The United States has been grappling with how to approach homeless encampments in recent years, with some cities and states banning them entirely. In 2024, the Supreme Court upheld an Oregon city's ban on homeless people sleeping outdoors, saying it did not violate the Constitution's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. The decision has reverberated around the country. "Homeless encampment sweeps are ineffective, they are costly, and they don't actually solve the problem of homeless," said Jeremy Saunders, an executive director of Vocal NY. "What's disappointing for us right now is really that Mamdani campaigned on addressing the affordability crisis and homelessness in New York." At the homeless encampment on 18th Street and 6th Avenue, Sasha Jones, 37, said that in the past, when the city dismantled an encampment she was sleeping in, she appreciated that homeless services workers were focused on outreach and moving people to shelters. In March 2025, during the Adams administration, Ms. Jones had been sleeping in an encampment on 30th Street that was cleared. Outreach workers asked her if she wanted to be transported to a shelter. Still, Ms. Jones said she was frustrated by the Mamdani administration's move. "I think it's atrocious that they're going to move encampments that aren't in front of businesses," she said. Corn Lady builds a culinary empire with a side of scorn. By John Elegon and Yvonne Muka. Just about everyone close to Chefiso Marumo condemned her when she chose to sell ears of corn door-to-door a decade ago after earning an honors degree from a university in her native Botswana. It was the sort of thing that people in the southern African nation looked down upon as poor people's work, not something for a sophisticated graduate with dreams of becoming a journalist. One of her former professors was so dismayed that he derisively nicknamed her Mamidi, a Setswana term that roughly translates to corn lady. Ms. Marumo, 33, shrugged off the criticism and has since turned that humble beginning into what many people in Botswana call a tale of triumph and inspiration. She has opened two roadside food stalls in the capital, Gaborone, that have become a hit, selling traditional village cooking that you almost never find in urban areas. Her venture has turned the unglamorous work of roadside food vending into something fashionable, earning her a large social media following and prominent customers, including politicians, musicians, and influencers. Yet the same qualities that have aided Ms. Marumo's rise, persistence, candor, and stubbornness, have also made her a divisive figure. The more prominent she has become, the louder she has spoken out online about hot-button issues like parenting and drug addiction, earning her a reputation among some as a social media bully. On Facebook, one of Botswana's primary social media platforms, Ms. Marumo has more than 240,000 followers, the equivalent of nearly 10% of Botswana's population. She called the business Mamidi, after the former professor's nickname, and plastered it onto T-shirts, aprons, and two company cars. "There are so many things I could have done, but they have never given me a brand or a name or an identity," she said. "But through the corn, I got an identity." Ms. Marumo likes to say she sparked controversy even before she was born. Her mother became pregnant with her as a teenager, upsetting many family members. Growing up, Ms. Marumo bounced between Gaborone, where her mother worked as a police officer, and Kalamer, a village 3 hours away where she stayed with her grandmother. Her grandmother ran an illegal tavern out of their home, something that was frowned upon in the community. But Ms. Marumo said she had no shame in the family business because she was always well taken care of. Her grandmother taught her how to cook, and that interest grew when she took home economics in school. Ms. Marumo started her cooking business after building a following with her corn sales. She began hosting dinners at her home, cooking Tswana food in the traditional style, in three-legged cast iron pots over a wood-fired flame. The dishes are seasoned mostly with just salt and natural fats, a traditional technique meant to bring out the true flavors of the meats, starches, and vegetables. Her dinners became so popular, she said, that in late 2019, she cleared out a bushy field at a busy intersection near her home and set up her first food stall. Offering village cooking on a street corner near Gaborone's central business district, Ms. Marumo's enterprise was a welcome departure for many locals from the usual fare of westernized food, showered in spices, served up by chain restaurants. "I'm passionate about my heritage, where I'm from, and what my ancestors consumed before me," a satisfied Orabatsi Makgolo, 37, said after eating at Ms. Marumo's stall for the first time recently. "Unfortunately, we consume a lot of Western food, and it's always nice to be in touch with the local side of yourself." In January, Ms. Marumo opened a second food stall. Both are unfussy stands made of wood with flat tin sheet roofs sitting on dirt lots. She now employs 11 workers. They come to her modest bungalow every morning at 6, where they fire up about 30 pots under a shelter in the backyard, cooking the day's menu in a swirl of heat and eye-burning smoke. The result on a recent day was a spread that included a shredded beef dish known as sessoa, a similar version mixed with tripe called mokoto, and bogobe jwa lerotsi, a thick porridge of sorghum and melon juice. 2 years ago, Ms. Marumo ventured into a new enterprise, holding the first of what she said would be annual women's empowerment seminars. But given her reputation as an online bully, many are unconvinced that Ms. Marumo is a true champion of women. On social media, she has criticized how some mothers raise their children and questioned the wisdom of some people's decision to have children in the first place. Online commenters have in turn attacked Ms. Marumo with negative comments about her body. They have criticized her food as soily, meaning it tastes like dirt. Thato San, a Botswana native who owns a beauty brand, said she was shocked last year when Ms. Marumo suggested online that Ms. San may have been complicit in the drug addiction of one of her friends, a rapper who had recently died. Just months earlier, Ms. San said, she had nominated Ms. Marumo for special recognition at a Women's Month brunch. "It was disappointing because I looked up to her," she said. "Her presence on social media, a lot of people would say, is very, very negative." Ms. Marumo argues that she is misunderstood and that her words are often twisted. Her success, she said, had bred contempt and made people feel that they could say anything about her. She feels compelled to speak about women's issues because of her own experience overcoming doubters, she said. Mothers often contact her for help with their children, and she has volunteered with and raised funds for an orphanage, experiences that Ms. Marumo said have given her a motherly instinct, even though she does not have children of her own. "I am known by many people, but I'm still human," she said. "I want my freedom. I need my freedom of expression." That concludes this Thursday's reading from the New York Times. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.